Then we'll ask the commentators up here on the stage. And here comes Adebayo Olukoshi. Adebayo has a long CV, and he has many talents. He's originally a professor of political science in Nigeria, but have been working here in Sweden for the Nordic Africa Institute, where he used to write a lot of reports on the influence of IMF and the World Bank on governance in Africa. Then you moved on to become Secretary General for CODESRIA in Dakar, which is a network of research network on the African continent, social science. Moving on to UNIDEP, which is a training institute in the UN for African civil servants, high-level civil servants. And now you're Africa head of the IDEA, International IDEA Democracy Organization.
Okay, we're also very happy to welcome Per Molander to the panel. I understand you're today celebrating your first day in freedom, as it were. You're now formally retired from your latest position as director of the Swedish Social Insurance Inspectorate. Well, I'm sure that Per's experience and intellectual interests span a wide area. I mean, I understand from physics to government reform, political philosophy and debate, economy and religion, which is reflected in many books that you have authored. You also made crucial contributions to reforming the Swedish state budgetary process after the financial crisis in the early 1990s, and I think that's the main reason why you're here. So, thank you.
And we also have Pernilla Trägård here, who is international director at the Statistics Sweden, which is a Swedish authority which does its own aid work, you could say, development cooperation work in the field of statistics. Pernilla, you have a long period of experience also from SIDA and elsewhere in development cooperation. You've been working in Nicaragua and Uganda and working on human security, on democracy, other areas as well. So you have a long experience on the practice of development cooperation. So you're most welcome. Eva, shall we say something about this, or we let Adebayo perhaps start with
I think
some
idea
comments?
Is that you each in turn give your comments, and then we have a panel discussion. And if you want to stay here, and this, or if you want to sit down here, that's up to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. I'm very delighted to be here, and thanks to Matt and colleagues for the invitation. It's very difficult to comment on a paper which, after you read, you feel you agree with the essential orientation of the analysis. We've come a long way from the early 1980s, when the approach to reform primarily consisted of the deployment of conditionality and cross-conditionality, the use of shock therapy approaches to basically compel adherence to reform measures prescribed mainly by the international financial institutions. We are in an age in which many who work in the development field now think that it is important to think and act more politically, something akin to the notion of realism, which Matt emphasized so much in his very interesting paper. Inevitably, as I read through the paper, I could not but recall some of the debates which we had on the African continent in the context of the crisis of the early 1980s, in which essentially we asked the question that whether the main issue was confronting the African continent was that of getting prices right, as the international financial institutions had suggested, or getting the politics and governance right. Now, place this side by side with the notion of the technical and the realism, which are central to the methodology in Matt Andrews' paper. I still feel 20, 30 years after that, without getting the governance political framework right, which is really a domestic political process at the end of the day. In many of the countries which need to undertake reforms, we are not going to go too far with any externally driven reform agenda or effort. And that much is, I think, clear from the paper which Matt has developed. What I find new and interesting is the emphasis which you have placed, Matt, on the ways in which those who seek to aid reformers in developing country contexts can better integrate their own lessons and experiences from home into the reform agenda in countries abroad. Not in a copycat way, as you said, but basically looking at what it is that worked and did not work in their context that might serve as a useful basis for shaping the kind of advice and the kind of input which they make in third country contexts. And it is, I think here I would like to make a few observations, more in a vein of wanting to push you a bit further in that regard, because in a sense the spotlight is now on the donor side, much more than on the recipient side. And here I would argue that one of the issues which seems to strike me reading your paper, and which has been at the back of my mind for some time, is what I would call, if I wanted to be really strong about it, I would call a disconnect, but perhaps more accurately, a loose connection between the development community in donor countries and the domestic reform community in the donor countries. That those who drove the Swedish reform agenda, which you described so extensively and which was celebrated as a success in the 1990s, are not the same people who drive the Swedish development cooperation agenda. And the loose connectivity between the two communities seems to me to be one of the areas which might merit some further attention if there were to be an Act 2 as a sequel to your very interesting study. Why is that connection not there more strongly? What can be done to better leverage it in a way that will ensure that when a country like Sweden steps out to a country like Mozambique, it does so on the basis of an integrated approach that draws much more strongly from its historical experience? Of course, it's not something that is terribly easy to achieve, I would say, because on the one hand, the development community, by its mandate and by its nature, actually does speak to an external audience, not necessarily an internal audience. Okay, there is an internal side to it. You have to justify that you are using taxpayers' monies correctly and that you are able to show results to the taxpayers who are willing to give up a part of the national revenues for external purposes. But the domestic reform agenda is driven by a community that by definition answers to a domestic commons. And these are two different dynamics, so that it is not difficult to see what you then describe in the paper, in which the development community in a country like Sweden is able to flow with a broader international development community, and in doing that flow, actually finds itself also in a sense, quote unquote, compelled to conform to the norms of that community, to the standards that are set by the multilateral institutions, for example, in terms of how to do public finance management reforms, and not basically wanting to be an outlier, apparently doing maverick things that don't conform to the international standard, which has been set by the leading players. And I feel that here, perhaps one of the steps which can be taken in seeking to remedy this disconnect is precisely the point you make about getting the development community to invest much more in leveraging knowledge about experiences at home for a broader international consumption, even if only for knowledge purposes. And now, of course, agencies like DFID, UKAID, have succeeded in positioning themselves as knowledge leaders amongst bilaterals, a position which the World Bank occupied amongst multilaterals for a very long period of time as knowledge leaders. We know what works, we know what doesn't work. And DeFi did this not necessarily because it's the biggest of the bilaterals, not even at a time when it was the biggest of the bilaterals, but simply investing in that knowledge component and claiming we know what works and we have the solution. And I suspect that in doing something similar with experiences such as those that have been accumulated in the Nordic context, we might in fact be creating a plurality of experiences and knowledges that can then enable countries to choose and deploy amongst themselves. A final point which I would like to make is also the possibility in terms of bridging the disconnect of ensuring that in contexts where twinning does occur, and I was fascinated by the Mozambican experience described in the paper, where twinning occurs in which people are seconded from, say, the tax authority in Sweden to the Ministry of Finance in Mozambique. One has to ask the question beyond the technical knowledge, and in order to infuse that realism which you mentioned, you say, what knowledge of Mozambique do they take with them? It's not surprising that there was a brick wall that was created by the fact that people couldn't speak Portuguese. It was difficult to communicate with their counterparts effectively over a period of time. But what knowledge of Mozambique do experts who are seconded in a twinning arrangement carry of the history and of the context to which they are planted over and above their technical expertise, which in fact recommended them in the first instance for the secondment and the twinning in question? I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Shall we ask Per to say a few words, comments? Okay.
Thank you for the invitation. As a general point of departure, I just want to make clear, I sympathize with Matt's description here, general story, both in the description of the current state of affairs and in his diagnosis of why things tend to go wrong. So I'm not going to take issue on anything important here. I just want to stress a few points based on my own experience and my own prejudice. Now, in my view, what makes a country successful is the way it manages to deal with two basic problems of governance. And the first of these two problems is the collective action problem, or the prisoner's dilemma of governance, if you like. How do you fit interests together, whether we are talking about lobbying groups or line ministries or whatever? How do you match those into a common framework? And the second problem is the time consistency problem. How do you trade current consumption against future possibilities? Those are the two basic problems of governance, and what we want to bring about in an institutional reform is basically a change of behavior among politicians, among civil servants at the top level and other important actors. Now, and as Matt quite correctly states, we tend to supplant this change of behavior with technical solutions. If we bring about some change in legislation, new routines, new codes of behavior, supported by IT systems and so on, we have accomplished this change of behavior, which we have not, of course. You can support a change in behavior by changing the legislation and building an IT system for public financial management, but you can't replace one with the other. On the other hand, I want to stress that a mere change in behavior is a rather brittle change, because if it's not supported by changes in legislation and IT systems and so on, it may be very short-lived. It may live with the current Minister of Finance or the current Prime Minister, but as soon as he or she is replaced, you may lose whatever you gain. So these two components are both necessary. Now, concerning the staffing, Matt draws a sharp borderline between multilateral and bilateral organizations. In my view, the important thing is whether the experts that you send to this foreign country have experience from working in the political sphere. And they may have that, whether they're working in a multilateral organization or bilateral, because there are a lot of people from the ministries of finance in around the world that end up in the IMF or the World Bank staff. So they may be quite useful, although they're working in the IMF. There may be still something important in what you say, that the bilateral bilaterally driven project has more degrees of freedom, that the IMF tends to be very stiff about its policies and its recommendations. But still, the important thing is the sort of the attitude and the experience of the experts that you send there. Now, the question raised earlier during my talk and also in the paper is what kind of experts do you need? Development cooperation experts or public financial management experts, if you are dealing with this field. And of course, the easy answer is that you need both. If I were forced to choose, I would opt for the second category. As Matt quite correctly stressed here, if you don't know the substance matter you are likely to run into problems. But whatever category they come from, they also need deep knowledge about the country where they are working. Local knowledge about the political conflicts, about the party coalitions, about ethnical cleavages, and so on. And so whatever your background, you need to study the country where you're working and realize, to have a humble attitude when entering the project in the field. Now, the big issue discussed is why hasn't Sweden been more active in this field of public financial management? And I believe there are a couple of different reasons. There are internal reasons and external reasons. Internally, there tend to be different communities. And here in Sweden, we have a development cooperation community and we have a public financial management community. And those are not the same people, and they don't necessarily talk to each other. I would say, in my experience, they do not talk to each other spontaneously. During my years in the Ministry of Finance and after the reform, I can't remember one single occasion when I was contacted from SIDA or any other important actor in development cooperation. So this doesn't happen automatically. Even within the agencies that are active, like the Public Financial Management Agency or the National Audit Agency, there tends to be some division of labor between those who are in the field and those who are experts in Sweden. There are no watertight chutes, but still there tend to be a certain category who go overseas and people who remain at home. And the first category is not always fully informed about what's happening at the frontier. The external reason why Sweden has been more active, I believe, there is competition in the field out there. Big countries like the United States, the UK, or France, they are defending their turf. They may have former colonies, or they may have an agenda to forward their positions. And that's reflected in what type of recommendations they are giving, and also whom they are prepared to let into the field. And unless you realize this competition for room, you won't get anywhere. So my conclusion will be very much like Matt's here. If we want a different state of affairs here in Sweden, concerning this particular field, the Swedish government has to declare its intention to move forward in this field. And you have to realize that it will not be just walking into the room and presenting your recommendations. You have probably a number of battles to in front of you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Pernilla, immediately.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Matt, for a very interesting report. I think it comes at a time that is very handy. Since the Swedish government is about to elaborate a new policy framework for development cooperation. And I would like to build on further what Per Molander was saying about the demand and also what Professor Olekoshi said about the demand. I'm working for Statistics Sweden, and I see that there is a huge demand for Swedish experiences and the knowledge of Swedish bureaucrats. I prefer to call it the Swedish bureaucrats and the bureaucratic system. It's not only for statistics, of course. It's for a lot of other important areas, audit, taxes, and much more, including financial management. We see this, and I believe that this demand has actually increased. And I compared it to when I was starting to work in development cooperation in the middle of the 90s. Yes, there was a demand, and I was working out in the embassies, and of course there was a demand for Swedish experiences. But as it is now, I believe it has fundamentally changed. And I thought about why do I see this increased demand for Swedish expertise in governance. One reason, I think, is that the scene has changed in terms of international cooperation and international dialogue. I mean, the world has shrunken, and you have a lot more international contacts when you are a civil servant within a state agency in Sweden or in any other countries. There are lots of more arenas for cooperation and for joint work to elaborate joint standards and methods and to revise these and to build on experiences from different parts of the world. We often, as Statistics Sweden, we sit in working groups with people from India, from the Philippines, from Serbia, and from Latin America at one and the same table. So, of course, there are a new way of interacting on the international scene that we did not really have 20 years ago, even if it was there. It's much more international cooperation today. And, of course, I mean, here it comes in, the sort of Nordic thing. I mean, as Nordics, because I here include also other countries like Norway, for example, that also have this constant demand for experiences. We have a solid reputation of our state agencies as being very modern and non-corrupt and easy to work with and really not imposing our ideas or systems. And there I agree with the previous speakers here. I mean, it's really not about what many others do. I mean, we've seen a development during the last 10 years where the British have actually created a whole force of public servants that are supposed to go on quick missions and solve the problems in a number of countries, and especially in the fragile states. We're not working in that way. We're working much more long-term and in a much more, according to me, maybe I'm biased, but in a more sustainable way in that sense. And the demand is perhaps larger than the supply at present, I would say, because, as the previous speaker also said, I mean, there has not been many very clear incentives to Swedish government agencies to invest in and to retain and to build up knowledge in peer-to-peer work for international project work as a comparison to all of these international working groups and task forces. So my take is that development officials and decision makers may have not always seen the potential, really, of Swedish knowledge and how it can be used, because it's not about blueprints, and it has very seldom been the case. And many government agencies, they have the possibility to work with international projects, but they must seek funding for it. They cannot use their own appropriation. We have a few exceptions here. One is the audit office, but for the rest of us, it's not the case. So I think that the focus has, since the initiation of the aid effectiveness agendas, been more on the constraint side, as also Matt points to in the report. I mean, it's been difficult to engage experts that are very busy on the national scene. It has been language barriers, context barriers, lack of knowledge about the context, etc. So it has simply been easier to work with multilaterals or through multilaterals and international consultants because they have been much more flexible. We have demanded a lot of planning time and a lot of systems in place in order to be that flexible. So I think if we want to do something more here, it needs to be a much more pragmatic stance on what Sweden wants to contribute with in work with government reform and government structures, not only the funding side. I mean, more can be done here to facilitate the use of Swedish experts and knowledge. And I would like also to stress the importance of people. I mean, we talk a lot about reform, institutions, and so on, but it's all made up of people. And when it's about people, it's about changes in attitudes and behavior. We heard it here previously as well. We all work with people, and people are part of the systems. And sometimes we tend to take very easily on this part of the puzzle in order to strive for the concrete results that we are very much pushed to do. Because, of course, we're working with taxpayers' money. And the term of change management has not been very dominant within development cooperation work. I mean, it's come up during the last couple of years. And I think that we all agree that change is everywhere, including within government structures. I mean, they take place, and they take place often in a not-so-coordinated or logical way that we would wish them to happen. So the whole idea, I would say, when you talk about institutional reform or support to institutions, is that you are trying with development cooperation to influence processes and improvements through changes in behavior and attitudes of the people. And on top of that, you're trying to do it in another context than your own. I mean, you don't exercise any control of this context. You might know a lot about it and have a lot of knowledge, but it's not the Swedish context. You don't have that control over where the taxpayers' money is going and how it is accounted for, etc. So we need to be very modest when we try to work with improving governance structures in other countries. And we need to take risks, and we need to know that there will be setbacks. My conviction is really that there is a need of a renewed pragmatism in Swedish development cooperation when we talk about supporting a well-functioning state apparatus through development cooperation. I think we need to invest in a much more dedicated work with a thorough understanding of politics. I mean, it's all about politics somewhere. And we heard about the loose connectivity before. So I think what we need to do in Sweden is really to cooperate different parts of the Swedish society that are engaged in terms of understanding the state apparatus, the role of politics and politicians, the relationship between the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, the role of the cabinet, the civil servants, and all that. And there we need to draw on each other's knowledge and experiences. I think by doing so, we can bring in more efficiency in programs and projects so that we have a common platform for the context in which we shall work in. I think also there needs to be a very clear mandate, a very strategic direction from the government to those Swedish state agencies that the government considers fit to engage upon request and demand from development cooperation. Specific assignments to those that the Swedish government identifies as the Swedish comparative advantage. This could be done with a certain maneuver room as well in order to build up structures and additional skills in terms of context, methods development, language, etc., so that we will be able to play a more prominent part in Team Sweden. I think it's all really fundamental. I also would like to add on that, I mean, institutions, state sectors, they're all dependent on people that have education and that have university education. I mean, that is something that Sweden has contributed to, but a lot more could be done in terms of investing in higher education. Because where are we going to draw our counterparts from in these state institutions, if not from universities within these countries that can educate and that can provide this these civil servants. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.